This shiur has been brought to you from the Sharim Audio Library. For information about Sharim or to order additional CDs, please visit our website, www.sharim.com, or email sharim@sharim.com. Thank you for making Sharim part of your continual learning experience.
Second Temple, and the crisis facing the Jewish people is going to get worse before it gets better. We discussed the emperors who rose up to dominate the Roman Empire in that period, and we discussed the Roman Emperor Trajan. Okay? And we discussed how Trajan was trying to make his inroads to try and conquer the Parthian Empire, to go east and conquer Babylon and Persia. And the Jews of Babylon actually joined in with the Parthians to resist Trajan. And then other Jewish communities also throughout the Roman world also participated in their uprising, and the result was a tremendous massacre of Jewish people. Okay, we said before that there were whole communities were completely destroyed. This was about 20 years after the destruction. This was an absolute major tragedy for the Jewish people. Okay, but this was an uprising and a rebellion that happened during the time of Trajan. That's what we got up to last time. Okay, now this stage we're going to. And after Trajan was the Roman Empire, was the emperor of the Roman Empire, he was followed by a man called Hadrian. Okay? Now Hadrian is one of the all-time villains in Jewish history. Okay? He's a real bad guy, we'll see. He didn't actually necessarily start it out by that. He actually started off by being quite conciliatory towards the Jews, but it didn't take long until his attitude changed. But before we get back to what actually happened with Hadrian, we have to talk about an extremely important figure, rabbinic figure, who made his appearance at this time. Well, actually, he didn't actually make his appearance at this time, but he became the dominant figure during this time, and it's a person that you've all heard about, and I want to speak about him today, because he's one of the really great heroes of Jewish people. In other words, when you see an absolutely amazing phenomenon, that even at the worst times in Jewish history, in other words, when Hadrian became the empire, it was one of the most tragic, bloody, damaging times for the Jewish people, but at the same time, going on exactly at the same time, you had one of the greatest Jewish leaders of all time leading the Jewish people. And as a matter of fact, we even see there's a certain flourishing in Torah scholarship that's going on at exactly the same time. In other words, it's this idea that, and it's an idea that I've tried to emphasize a number of times, that even when things are as bad as they are, Hashem never abandons the Jewish people. It's a beautiful passage that says, Ki lo yitosh Hashem amo. Hashem will never abandon his people, and his inheritance, he never abandons them. Even in the most desperate times, he provides them with people. Sometimes in the darkest times, we have some of the greatest people, Dafka. And this is a salient feature in Jewish history. The other place you will see, the place where it's absolutely striking, is in the Middle Ages, and with the Crusades, 300 years of just unrelieved misery for the Jewish people. At the same time, it produced one of the greatest and most important times opening up in Jewish scholarship in the whole of Jewish history. Came exactly at the same time when the Jewish people were being relentlessly and ruthlessly being persecuted. If anybody just sees this, it just sees that no matter how bad it is, Hashem has never left us. Okay? Who is the great figure who becomes a dominant this time? It's a man called Akiva ben Yosef, Rabbi Akiva. I have to speak a little bit about Rabbi Akiva, because Rabbi Akiva is such a great figure, and there's so much said about Rabbi Akiva. I want to share some of the stories a little bit about you so you know this great figure. But he was the leader, he became at this time the leader of the generation at this terrible crisis. And Rabbi Akiva was the leader of the generation. Let's speak a little bit, maybe you won't know, but it's important to go over it. Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest figures in Jewish history of all times. If you want to know how great he was, I'll tell you a little medrash. The medrash says, it's not just a medrash, it's a gemara. The gemara says the following. It says, when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Har Sinai to get the Torah, he says he saw Hashem attaching crowns to the letters of the Sefer Torah. Now, I don't know if you have a look in the Sefer Torah, but some letters have on them something called tagim. Tagim are like little crowns. Do you know what I'm talking about? Does anybody know what you're talking about? Mm-hmm. Hashem, what are these for? What are these crowns on the letters? These they're called tagim. Tagim. What are these tagim? What are they for? So Hashem said, there's going to be a person in subsequent generations. and his name is Akiva ben Yosef, and he is going to interpret from each one of these tagim, he's going to be able to derive mountains and mountains and mountains of halachas. Right? Interpret the way he tells. How he did it, I have not the slightest idea. So Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, let me see him. So Hashem put Moshe Rabbeinu in a time machine, and he saw Rabbi Akiva sitting there in front of his Talmidim. Moshe Rabbeinu sat in the eighth row. In other words, the Talmidim would sit in rows according to their seniority and their ability. Moshe Rabbeinu got an eighth row seat. And he saw Rabbi Akiva dashing, interpreting from every single one of these tagim, and Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have a clue what was going on. Okay? This is the reason he didn't have a clue, because at this stage he hadn't actually received the Torah yet. He's going to get the Torah yet. So he was there, and as interpreting this halachas, one of the Talmidim said to Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi, where do you get this one from? Where do you see that halacha? By the way, Moshe Rabbeinu was watching all of this, and he's feeling very bad because he's not understanding the thing. And he's Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Not because of personal reasons, okay, but he doesn't. So he said, one of the Talmidim said to Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi, where do you know this from? And he said, halacha la Moshe v'sinai. This is a inheritance from Moshe himself. So Moshe Rabbeinu was pacified. Not because of Shalom for his ego, okay? But what do we see? So Hashem said, he said, now this is the words I wanted to really get to. Hashem, Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, Hashem, why are you giving the Torah through me? You should give the Torah to the Jewish people through him. He should be the one to give the Torah to the Jewish people. Okay? So Hashem said, this is my plan, this is what I have in mind. I don't have to answer all of your questions. This is what I want. But what do you see? You see, from the very beginning, this figure, Akiva ben Yosef, the great Rabbi Akiva, he was already earmarked as one of the greatest figures in Jewish people. He was a person that Moshe Rabbeinu himself said to Hashem, he's the one that the Torah should be given to. He was already predestined, so to speak, in all of history. We're going to see that there is, well, I don't know if we'll get that today, I hope maybe we will. There was a group of ten great tzaddikim called the Asera Harugei Malchus. There's 10 martyrs who were killed by the government. Have you ever heard of them? We talk about them on, we have a special tefillah for them on Yom Kippur, and also on the Tisha B'Av. These are called the 10 great sages, the martyrs who were killed by the Romans. This 10 groups were the, generally regarded, we'll speak about it when we get there, these 10 were regarded as the greatest group of tzaddikim that existed in Klal Yisrael since the time of the Shvatim, since the time of Moshe, of Yaakov's sons, right? And they are called Rabbi Akiva and his friends. In other words, Rabbi Akiva was the head of this pretty illustrious and elite group. Rabbi Akiva was a man, I don't know if I've succeeded in telling you, in trying to persuade you, because I don't even know it myself, so I don't know how I'm supposed to persuade anybody else, but Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest figures of all times. And he's the figure that Hashem has put at the head of the generation at this terrible time of crisis. You probably know, yeah.
Was this when you had two leaders?
Well, the truth is like this. What's really interesting is like this. There was this period where we had two leaders. One was called a Nasi, and one was called the head of the Beit Din. And this was a traditional thing. This actually wasn't so operative at this stage. The greatness of Rabbi Akiva is Rabbi Akiva was neither of the two. This is going to show, by the way, this is a salient feature in all Jewish history from this time, is that very often you find that the great figure of the generation is a person who has no official position whatsoever. He's the head of the generation because he's great. He doesn't have to be the chief rabbi of anything. Right? We've seen this in recent generations. The Chofetz Chaim was the greatest figure of his generation. You know, he had a makolet.
Right?
Do you know there's a famous story? There was a famous story that once the Chofetz Chaim was going to speak to the Polish Minister of Education, going with the delegation, right? And they realized he didn't even have a smicha. The Chofetz Chaim was part from the same Chofetz Chaim.
Polish.
He was going to speak to the Polish Minister of Education.
The Jewish education.
Well, he was the minister for the education of all of Poland. But a delegation of rabbis were going to speak to him about certain things that affected the Jews. And it wasn't really appropriate to go and speak to him unless you're a rabbi. All of a sudden, they realized the Chofetz Chaim, who has written the Mishnah Berurah, which is the single most authoritative halachic work written in the last 150 years, he doesn't even have a smicha. Okay?
Someone gave him one.
Yes. Someone gave him one. Rav Chaim Moshe Grushinsky gave him a smicha on the spot. But all I'm showing you is that in the Torah world, greatness, a person is great. A person is a leader because he's great. You understand what I'm saying? You don't have to embellish a person necessarily with an official position or a title. He's recognized as the greatest figure, of the generation, and he gets the leadership for that reason. He assumes leadership because he's recognized for that reason. Rabbi Akiva was an example of this. Now, as you probably know, the Torah tells us that Rabbi Akiva was an Amoritz. You know what that means? He was ignorant. He didn't know anything. Right? He didn't start to learn Torah until he was the age of 40 years old. He was the son of a ger. Also,
he was
right?
He
knew that he was, of course, he was Jewish, and he kept the mitzvahs, but he was completely unlearned.
But his father didn't teach him anything?
It says, we're going to see in the Gemara, when the Chazal tell us, that when Rabbi Akiva was the age of 40 and he started to learn, he went to learn Aleph Bet. Okay? However, the Gemara says that Rabbi Akiva had one thing going for him. Well, he had many things going for him. Obviously, there was this potential. He was called Sanua Umayya. He was Sanua. You ever know what Sanua means? Right? He was modest. And he presents very, very noble meters, character traits. And the great thing about Rabbi Akiva is that if you want to produce this edifice called Rabbi Akiva, he was produced together with one of the greatest women of Jewish history. This is Rochel Bat Kalba Savua. Rabbi Akiva was a shepherd for a man called Kalba Savua. Kalba Savua was a very, very wealthy man, and Rabbi Akiva was a shepherd, and Rochel was the daughter of Kalba Savua. Now, Kalba Savua, apart from being a very wealthy man, was a learned man, and obviously he wanted the best for his daughter. She was like a princess, and of course he wanted just the best possible shidduch for his daughter, as you could possibly imagine, and probably had the money to make sure he got it as well. Right? But Rochel recognized the greatness. She was the one who recognized and realized the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. Now, please don't forgive me if I'm telling you, but you probably know these stories, but I just go through them a little bit quickly. It says that she went to Rabbi Akiva, and she said to him, If I will agree to marry you, will you go to learn Torah? And he said, yes. And so she was. She agreed, and they became married. And when Kalba Savua found out about this, her father found out about this, he was so incensed that his daughter, his precious, beautiful daughter, who was sought after by all the great, famous, wealthy, learned people as a bride, she'd gone ahead and she'd married an ignoramus shepherd. Okay? So what did he do? He cut her off. He completely dispossessed her of all of his possessions. So she was reduced to living in utter poverty. Can you imagine? She went from being the daughter of one of the richest men who ever lived, right on, a very, very wealthy person, and now she was in a situation of the most abject poverty because of her dedication and devotion to Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva, in the first year, by the way, I just mentioned to you, Rabbi Akiva was born. This was, by the way, we're talking about still during the Second Temple period. This was the time we're speaking about, and still before the Temple was destroyed. We're going back in history. Okay? Well, Rabbi Akiva was born about the end of Hillel's life. So we're talking around about, he would have been born in round about 10, something like that, CE. Give or take a year here or there, approximately. Maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more. Okay? We're in the beginning of the first millennia, according to the way they count. Okay? Right there at the beginning. Okay? The Chazal tell us that they lived in such poverty, and that he would go and learn, that they had to, it says that Rabbi Akiva, right, he began learning, and as we said before, he had to learn, start from the very, very beginning, he had to start learning Aleph Beis. It says that they would sleep on the floor, on straw. It says in the morning he would have to pluck the straw out of her hair. So this is what it was told, Chazal tell us. Okay? It says that, you know what she did in order to support Rabbi Akiva? She said, Chazal tell us, she sold her braids. She sold her hair. I didn't know there was a market for it, but now they tell me there is. Okay? She sold her braids. She sold her braids in order to support Rabbi Akiva. We haven't finished with the Rachel yet. Okay? Rabbi Akiva, I'll just tell you a beautiful idea that I once heard. He says that there was this person, if there was ever a person who went through the most immense self-sacrifice, it was Rachel. Okay? Because she recognized the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. She was the one who saw it. And, right? It says that the Hillel are living in the most terrible, terrible poverty with almost nothing. Right? So Rabbi Akiva said to her, he said, if only I had the money, I would buy for you a golden ornament. It's called Yushalayim Shel Zahav. Now, I don't know what that is exactly. It's called Yushalayim Shel Zahav. It was a certain ornament that was there. And he's Rabbi Akiva said, if only I had the ability, I would buy it for you. Okay? Now, I once heard from one of my teachers, he said the following thing. What was Rabbi Akiva telling you? All he's doing is, if I had the money, I'd buy it for you. Right? Here he is. Just reminding her. It's like another reminder of just what absolute abject poverty she has to suffer right now as a result of as a result of having married Rabbi Akiva, right? So what's she saying? So he answered the following question. He says, when you give a gift to a person, the gift is an expression of love and appreciation, right? Well, very often, there's two types of gifts you can give. You can give a gift to a person, a utilitarian gift, something the person needs, or you can give a gift just to make a bond. So this we're talking about, obviously an ornament is something that you give to create, to make a certain feeling and a bond between people. But Rabbi Akiva, he said it with such a sincerity and such a depth and such an appreciation that it was like he actually gave it to her. You understand what I'm saying? Later on, we'll find out that Rabbi Akiva, in the end of the later stage, he became very wealthy and he in fact bought her this very priceless fashion. But this was the story of Rachel. She then said, after he'd been learning for 1 year, she wanted him to go away and to learn by the rabbis. And she made up with him that he would go and learn for 12 full years. He would leave home and he didn't see her. He went off to learn. She, at this time, went out to work to support him so that he would be able to sit and learn. And he went off to learn. And he sat there. He had no mobile telephone, no calls home. 12 years he sat in front of the sages and he grew and he grew and he grew. After 12 years he came back. You know the famous story? After 12 years he came back. I'll just tell you the story. And as he was walking into the courtyard, some neighbor was saying to your husband is so terrible, he's abandoned you. And she said, if I had my way, he'd go back for another 12 years. So what did he do? He turned around and went back for another 12 years. He didn't even come in. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, the famous Rosh Hashiva of Mir, said, why didn't he at least come in and say hello? He says, because 12 years and 12 years is not as the same as for 24 years. In other words, it's completely unbroken devotion, single-minded devotion to Torah. The Gemara says that Rabbi Akiva reached his heights in Torah, his incredible heights in Torah, because he learned with every single fiber of his body. He learned to kol kocho with every single drop of energy that he had in Torah, and any distraction, right, even coming in to say hello, he didn't do it. So he came back. You all know the story. I have to tell you, this is a beautiful story, but it's so poignant, such a message for a Jewish woman. After 24 years, Rabbi Akiva returned. Remember, 24 years ago, he'd been an ignorant, illiterate shepherd. After 24 years, he returned at the head of 24,000 disciples. Okay? He was followed by 24,000 disciples. And when she was coming into town, Rachel said, I'm going out to greet him. And she said, she pushed her way through the crowd. And when she saw, she fell in front of him and she started kissing his feet. That's what the Gemara says. So one of the Talmidim, they didn't recognize it was her. Here she was a woman in rags. And they tried to push her away. And Rabbi Akiva said the immortal words, you know what he said? He said, leave her. Sheli, v'shelachem, shela. You understand that? Sheli, mine, what's it? All my Torah, v'shelachem, and all your Torah, shela, it's hers. My Torah, and your Torah, it's all hers. That was the famous story of Rachel. Sheli, v'shelachem, shela. Three words. Rachel was one of the greatest women. She was the what do I want to bring out of this? Even though Rabbi Akiva, with all of his greatness, one of the Rabbi Akiva is in the front rank of the greatest Jews of all times, But we see the Chazala telling us what was the thing that made Rabbi Akiva, that brought out Rabbi Akiva's true potential, was a woman called Rachel. Okay? This is the message which I'm trying to get out, that the role of a woman in building this edifice called Rebbe, it could not have been a Rebbe Akiva had it not been for Rachel, who recognized and encouraged and sacrificed, and therefore truly say, Shali v'shalachem shalach. By the way, you should know, Chazal, when the sages speak, they never speak in exaggerations, or every word is extremely precise. So that's what Chazal tells us about that. Rebbe Akiva, then, as one of the greatest sages of his time, he wasn't yet the head of the generation, he went to set up his yeshiva in Bnei Brak. Anyone know, on the level of Seder, we talk about the sages who were reclining in Bnei Brak, together with Rebbe Akiva, because that was the city where Rebbe Akiva lived, and he was there throughout the whole period of the second end of the Second Temple. That's why he was not in Yerushalayim during the destruction of the Second Temple, because he was in his yeshiva in Bnei Brak with his Talmidim. And he rose to be one of the great, great leaders of the generation. In the generation following the destruction, we know the great leader initially was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. This great figure, this is called Ner Yisrael, Omer Hayamim, the light of Israel, the right hand pillar. He was the guiding figure who engineered this saving of the Jewish people in the yeshiva in Yavne. After he passed away, Rabbi Akiva now became the head of the generation. He was the towering figure in his generation, and he was the one that, even though the Roman clutches are going to embed their claws into the Jewish people, it's going to become a terrible hardship. At the same time, there's this flowering of this person called Rabbi Akiva with a tremendous flourishing of Torah at the same time. Yeah.
Did they have children?
Yes. 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 There's a very famous story about Rabbi Akiva's daughter. Well, I'll tell you, there's a story about Rabbi Akiva's daughter that on the wedding day, right? You know the story on the wedding day?
No.
Yeah?
No.
She said, well, I think when I was getting ready for the preparations for the wedding, a poor person asked, came to knock on the door. Of course, in a wedding day, was getting ready for a wedding, so no one's got time to take care of it. And so she, the bride, she took the food from the wedding and she gave it to this poor person. Okay? People live very modestly, by the way, in those days. So, says at the time, so what she did was, she was, how do we know about this? Because it says that while she was doing her hair, she had a certain pin in her hair, and she took it out and she put it in the wall for a minute. And she, at that moment, a poisonous snake fell out of the wall. She had, like, stabbed in the snake. And Rabbi Akiva saw this, and he said, what have you done today to deserve such this miracle? And she told him the story. So, just this thing about it. Can you imagine? Would you, on your wedding, some poor person in rags, he doesn't even smell too good, right? Knocks on the door. That's how it works today. That's what they had. So she took what they want for the wedding. She gave it to the poor person. Okay. That's how people live once upon a time. Today, I don't know what you do. You say, listen, go over to the smorgasbord and take, you know, help yourself over there. Go to the bar and help yourself.
I was invited to the wedding.
Okay, good for you. Okay. By the way, you should just know, there are a lot of weddings you go to here in Yerushalayim. There's tables. I've been to one where there's tables of poor people coming to sit in the weddings. Okay.
So they.
I've seen this. Especially there's one place. There's one place in Meir Sharim. I went to a neighbor of mine had a wedding there. There were four tables. All these, beggars basically. No, they had absolutely no connection to the wedding. Only just came in. That was just the way they said.
They order extra food before.
I don't know if they do it so much anymore, but that's how it was in Yerushalayim. You have to have a few tables for the poor people to come and eat. Mikam chayisav b'yachavar. It sounds like the Jewish people. Okay. All right. So that's a little bit of the background. This is, in other words, at this time. I'm just pointing out that things are going to get very bleak, but you have to realize that it's a split screen over here, right? There's a split screen. At the same time, when we know there's an expression, how you're dying, Esau, the hands of Esau, and the kol Yaakov, is the voice of Yaakov. These two things are going on simultaneously at the same time. Now, so we have Rabbi Akiva in place. We've had a little window into Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was a very great person. We'll come back to Rabbi Akiva. shortly. But first of all, let's get back to, in the meantime, let's get back to Hadrian. Hadrian, as I said before, he was actually at the beginning quite well disposed. He actually tried to conciliate the Jews, but for some reason, and it's not clear exactly what the reason is, he had a change of mind in relation to the Jews, and he became a terrible, terrible butcher and oppressor of the Jews. First of all, by the way, we mentioned before, that initially he gave permission to the Jews to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah? And he says the Jews all over the world, he gave them actually permission to rebuild.
But
well,
didn't that coincide with the
Purim
story?
Oh, Purim isn't that. Purim is before the building of the Second Temple. Purim already was.
Right.
Purim was already about 500 years ago.
But wasn't it Esther's son who let them go back? To
yes,
the
it was. That was King Koresh. Right.
No, Darius.
Darius, right. Darius was the one who gave the permission.
So how did Hadrian sit into that?
No, I hate the one thing.
It's behind you.
Okay. These gentlemen over here. What you've got over here is the first three over here are the rulers of Babylon.
Right.
The next ones going down are the leaders of Persia and Media. Okay? And this is all taking place a good 500 years before the time we're talking about. More than 500 years before the time we're talking about. We've already passed through the Babylonian Empire. We've passed through the Persian Empire. We've passed through the Greek Empire. And now we're in the heyday of the Roman Empire.
So then just because the Jews went back to the Jewish shrine, they didn't rebuild the temple. So after the Purim story, even if some Jews went back to Jewish shrine, they didn't rebuild the temple.
Well, they didn't build the reway because when Koresh over here gave them permission, he was like a similar idea. Koresh actually made the proclamation at the beginning of Sefer Ezra. He was the one who made the proclamation giving the Jews the right to go back. And they started rebuilding. And then our old non-friends, the Samaritans, they actually started speaking Lashon and Hara about the Jewish people and saying that they were planning to rebel. And he withdrew the permission to build the temple. And so it took them another 17 to 18 years before they finally were able to finish building the temple. So this fits in. This, what we just mentioned right now, this we spoke about this second ago, this was to do with the building of the second temple.
Right.
Now the second temple stood for 420 years. Okay? So we're already talking right now about after the destruction of the second temple. What you were just talking now was before the second temple had even been built.
So then this is about the third temple?
Yeah.
He gave permission for the Jews to rebuild the temple, and that would have been the third one.
Okay.
I want you to know it never happened.
Right.
Because he was a piker. He was, yes. Okay, a piker. You know what a piker is? A piker is a person who piked out. Okay? He was a piker means he reneged. He reneged. He had a big change of heart. And right again, the Chazal say that it was the Kutites. I was wondering maybe sometimes the Kutites are sometimes it's a veiled reference to the Christians. I'm not sure if it is. But the Samaritans, they went and told that the Jews were planning to. The Medrash says that the Kutim actually went out and they told him the Jews were planning to rebel against him. And Hadrian changed his mind. Now since he'd already given permission to build a temple, right, and he really couldn't actually it wouldn't be very dignified to him just to say, "Oh, I've changed my mind." He said, "Well, we've had a slight plan, should change your plan. You're allowed to build the temple, but not exactly on this site. You have to move it over a little bit." And he knew that the temple has to be built in exactly a very specific site. And moving it anywhere means actually effectively reneging on the permission to build it. So that was the end of that. Okay? So that was like, it was a little, but you can imagine the excitement and the spirit of optimism all through the Jewish world. The Hadrian and New King had given permission to the Jews to rebuild the temple, and money was pouring in from all over the Jewish world, and tremendous excitement and optimism. And then it was all went up in smoke. But not even up in smoke, from this time on, Hadrian, exactly what happened and why it happened, I don't know. But Hadrian had a change of mind in his relationship with the Jews, and he became one of the most brutal and oppressive oppressors of the Jews of all times. Hadrian is a really dirty word for Jews. Okay? Okay. Now, it could be, by the way, that we can speculate why he changed his mind. Maybe one of the reasons he changed his mind is because we find in the course of history several times that certain friends of the Jewish people wanted to civilize and approach the Jews, but the Jews always stuck grimly to their traditions, and maybe that sometimes the friends, once they're offended, they become actually the worst enemies. Okay, but as I say, this is actually speculation, that he now cracked down on the Jews, and he actually enacted certain elements of what we call Gzeiras Shmad. And Gzeiras Shmad means a decrees that are designed for the annihilation, spiritual annihilation of the Jewish people. Okay? We had these during the times of Antiochus, before the Purim miracle, before the Purim story. In other words, this is nearly 300 years earlier. Hanukkah story, through the Hanukkah story, we had similar type of things, but he had initiated this stage, at this stage, Gzeiras Shmad, he forbade the Jews the following mitzvahs: Shabbos, Mila, Bris Mila, Taharat HaMishpacha, family purity, and to say Kriya Shema. Okay? How will they check? You know how they check? Just tell you something interesting. I'll tell you something. I don't know. Have you ever been to a Beit Knesset on Shabbat and in Musaf, in Musaf? Yeah. Is anybody Have you ever been in? Have you ever been there? Have you ever been in Musaf and in Beit Knesset?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to offend you. I really shouldn't have said that. Okay. No, I didn't. Now, have you noticed when the congregation says kedusha, really kedusha, yeah? In other words, we say Shema Yisrael. Shema Yisrael, Shema Lekeinu, Shema Echad. Right? Have you ever noticed that? Can you ask? Can you tell me a question? What in the world is Shema Yisrael doing in the middle of kedusha? Did you ever think about that? Okay, I'll tell you. I'll tell you. This goes back to this period of time. That the Romans would have policemen going around all of the shuls, right, to make sure that the Jews would not say that they had agents and spies, right? We're not talking about if a Jew wants to go and stay in his house, lock himself in his room, and hide under the bed. No, they had to feel about it. Of course they did. They had it already many times before.
Since the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed.
Yes, of course they had Shema Yisrael.
No, after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, they had the Shema Yisrael. Before they didn't have it.
No, they did have it.
You told us we didn't.
No, I said like this. There's a question like this. We know the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, that's at the beginning of the Second Temple period, they were the ones who already made the Shema Yisrael. The question is, when in Yavne, the question is that the number of opinions, what they did, whether certain discrepancies came into the Nusach, or whether they actually made an obligation to do it, or the order of it, but there'd always been a Musag, there'd always been a concept of Shema Yisrael until then. Okay? But what they did was they had the policemen running around, and of course you say Shema Yisrael in Shacharit, in the first part of the davening. So what they did was, so in order they would have at least one time a day they would have it, right? They would actually, they already left, and when they finished davening Shabbos, they said they hadn't said it. So they said it in Musaf. After they were made this takon to say it, and actually in the kedusha of Musa, after this was the time when the spies had already left the shul because the time the normal you would say it was already passed. So this is why they put it in there. That's why they made this decree to put it in there.
You asking? Picked up on it.
But nobody picked up on it. It's a good question. Okay. I don't know.
And then I just thought, I wonder what happens.
That was the takana that they made to say the Kriyashma. And even though it was the need for the takana, the need for it actually after a while wasn't relevant anymore. But once they'd already made that takana, they kept it. By the way, just tell you one other thing again. It's not actually at this period now; it's going to be slightly later on. But one of the things that they also forbade was publicly reading the Torah, right? They forbid reading the Torah in public. That wasn't quite, this stage is going to come at a later stage, but it's just a similar idea. So this was the reason why they introduced the minhag of reading the Haftorah. You know what we read the Haftorah? You know what the Haftorah is? It's a portion from the Navi, from the Nevi'im, which is bears some kind of similarity to the topic of the parasha. And they also pick something with 21, generally speaking, 21 psukim, or at least the completing, because normally you have seven people being called up to the Torah, and each one reads a minimum of three psukim. So that's why they picked it out, 21 psukim. Sometimes it's less, because if it's a complete It's a complete topic. It can be also less than 21, but usually that's the principal 21 psukim. And it was something that corresponded with the normal Torah, and they implemented that. It was also not quite at this time, but it's a similar idea that, well, we still do to this very day, which is a residue of those gezeiros that they made, that the Romans made. Okay? Okay? So some of the things that we live with as part of our humdrum, still is part of the tikkunos that they made to respond to the Roman oppression. Yeah.
In the Shema, they were saying,
Kedusha,
why don't people cover their eyes?
I don't know. It could be that it's not, if you cover your eyes, it's not ma'akir. If you don't cover your eyes, you're Yotze Shmeina Esrei. The only reason you cover your eyes in Shmeina Esrei, the only reason you cover in Shema, is because, so you shouldn't be distracted. Okay, I know some people that don't even cover their eyes; they just close their eyes. Okay, but I'm just saying that maybe then they did it. We're only doing it right now they kept the tikkun when that was the reason they made it. Once they made it, we still do it. Okay, all right. One other very interesting thing that Hadrian did was, and by the way, you probably saw this. There's a museum in the Citadel of David called the Citadel of David Museum? Tower of David. The exhibits there are really very interesting. I wouldn't mind taking a group there I would like to give a slightly more kosher explanations. It's very well done. The exhibits are very, very impressive. And it's very good. But one of the things you'll see there, if you've already been there, if you haven't gone there, you'll see that they show you how at this time the Romans made a decree forbidding any Jews, first of all, any Jews from outside of Israel coming to Israel, and any Jews within Eretz Israel coming into Yerushalayim. They turned Yerushalayim into a completely non-Jewish city. They called it Elia Capitolonia. Elia Capitolonia. Do you remember that?
They had this really cool video.
Yeah.
That they went through all the different names it had and all the different people who'd been.
Right. This is a name that we don't have to necessarily honor so much. No. Aliela Capitolina, by the way, what are these two names? Aliela Capitolina. Aliela was Hadrian's middle name. So the first thing is named it after himself. And Capitolonia is a reference to Jupiter. I guess that's how they must have called Jupiter. Jupiter was one of their main idols. And he actually built a pagan temple with a statue of Jupiter on the temple mount. Okay? So this was, in other words, we're talking about right now. You can realize what's happening. This is part of the thing over here to turn Yerushalayim into a completely non-Jewish entity. Now, Jews were forbidden to come into Yerushalayim. They have an exhibit there, and this is one of the things over here. It became and the Temple Mount, that's where the base of Midrash was, became the temple for the idol Jupiter. That's where we're holding Yak. Okay? Now, this is going to, I don't know if we'll get to it today, this actually triggered off a very famous rebellion. The rebellion is going to be the rebellion of a man called, we'll see, it's going to gel under a man called Shimon Bar Kosiba. Okay, Shimon Bar Kosiba. And what's going to happen is, maybe we'll just give an introductory word over here. A Roman historians want to say that the causal effect of the rebellion was this act of turning Yerushalayim into a non-Jewish city and building a pagan temple on the Temple Mount. According to the Roman history, that's how they explain the what actually sparked off the rebellion. However, in Jewish writings, there is no reference to it at all. So this would seem to indicate that, according to Jewish writings, that this actually wasn't the thing which sparked off the rebellion, the famous Bar Kokhba rebellion. Have you all heard of the Bar Kokhba rebellion? This is Shimon Bar Kosiva. Rabbi Akiva, we're going to see soon, Rabbi Akiva was a big supporter of this Shimon Bar Kosiva. He changed his mind later on, but he saw the actual the astonishing achievements of this person, Shimon Bar Kosiva, and he actually thought he was the Mashiach. In other words, that which we have mentioned a number of times, that the sages have actually taken a stance not to rebel against the Romans, not to rebel against the nations. The reason is because, we mentioned before, that Hashem made the Jewish people take an oath and they just have to accept the yoke of the nations. However, this is until such time as the Mashiach comes. But when Mashiach comes, again, Mashiach comes, a different story. Rabbi Akiva actually thought, this is what it says in the Be'er Hamikdash, Rabbi Akiva actually thought that this person, Shimon bar Kasida, was the Mashiach, and that's why he called him Bar Kochba. What's Bar Kochba? It says in the Chumash, if you take a look in the Midbar Kof Dalad Yud Zayin, the pasuk says, Dorach Koichav Yaakov. A star came out from Yaakov. Rashi explains this is a reference to Mashiach, and that's why he called him Bar Kochba, the son of the star. Okay? In this reference to Mashiach. And we're going to see right now that it comes out like this, that these, if we want to look at it from our point of view, it is the cause of this rebellion. We'll have to speak about it next time. The cause of the rebellion was really in Jewish terms. If it was just having to accept the oppressions of the Romans, they probably just would have gripped their teeth and bear it. But when they make what's called a Gzeirah Shmat, when there is an attempt to destroy the Jewish people spiritually, then this will cause for a different type of response altogether. This was probably the true reason for the Bar Kochba rebellion, which we will start on Sunday, Mr. Shem, we'll talk about. This was the famous rebellion, which was very nearly successful. It was really absolutely extraordinary what this Bar Kochba did. It's a very interesting chapter. And really, it's the close of a whole era. Just boy, a tremendous tragedy. We'll speak about it then. But anyway, today, we'll just sum up where we're holding. We're summing up right now that Hadrian has actually cracking down on the Jewish people. He has introduced terrible oppression and affliction on the Jewish people. He's attacking the Jewish people right now, not just physically, but also spiritually. And at this stage, the Jewish people are getting ready now for tremendous conflict, physical conflict with the Roman Empire, which I'll just cheat a little bit and tell you that they lost, in case you didn't know. End up losing this one, and it's going to be the end of a period, but we have also met today one of these great, great towering figures. We'll get back to him, maybe Akiva Ben Yosef. The one thing to remember out of all of this is this concept, Hashem never leaves the Jewish people alone. In the darkest hours, in the worst times, he always provides them with a leader, with a fight, with an achievement, with an effort.